Good morning, saints. I know what the clock says, but my biorhythms are saying something different. How about yours? We're working our way during the season of Lent, we're working our way through several chapters of the Gospel of Matthew. We're looking at the so-called Sermon on the Mount. And you might remember that last week we started by looking at the Beatitudes. Beatitude is a Latin word. It simply means a blessing. And Jesus starts very simply when he opens his address. And he starts by talking to those who are with him. And he says, "Blessed are you who are poor in spirit, for yours is the kingdom of heaven." That's a statement about us. If there's anybody who came here this morning who's feeling poorly in spirit, anybody who's slightly dispirited, well, this might be a word for you and a message that would have been prepared for you. Blessed are you who are poor in spirit. And I think Jesus knows. He knew those who had come to listen to him. He knew them, and he knew them well. And a lot of people, that's where they lived. They were impoverished in spirit. They were looking for hope and looking for help. And Jesus had a word of good news for them. And I love what he said. Blessed are you, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. I think he's saying it belongs to you. It's yours now. It's already here. That was the message of Jesus. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. It's as close as the hand at the end of your arm. It's that near to you, as close as the nose at the end of your face. That's how close it is, and it belongs to you. It's yours. Now, when Jesus gathered people on this particular occasion, there were great crowds, a multitude of people gathered around. But in particular, Jesus offered a message for his disciples. And when Matthew records this particular sermon, this is one of four discourses in the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew is writing to a Jewish Christian community. Matthew knew the law, the Torah. He knew the Jewish scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, extremely well. So he's writing to a group of people who really knew the law. They were steeped in it. They had grown up in it. These were people who had been Jewish, but who also became acquainted with Jesus and understood him to be the Messiah. So what Matthew is doing is presenting for later generations certain teaching tools. It's called a catechism. And so Matthew wants to record these words of Jesus for future generations so that we can learn from what Jesus had to say and teach. So that's what I'm going to do this morning, a little bit of teaching. I didn't bring one Bible. I brought two, just to keep myself honest here. And I'm remembering some time ago, I have a friend, and he's often in touch and attuned to the words that we speak. And some of the words that we use today when something powerful happens or something good, something that we really appreciate, really like, and we say, "Perfect." You ever use that expression? Perfect. Perfect. How was that? Oh, it was perfect. You got the dinner just right. How was the movie? How was the evening? Perfect. We had the time of our lives. Perfect. That's one of the words that we use. And we sometimes use another word, awesome. Have you ever told somebody and said to them, "You're awesome"? Maybe you've said it to your spouse, "You're awesome." And this is a very close friend of mine. And he had done something incredibly, amazingly kind. And I just said to him, and I said, "You know, you're awesome." And when I said that, he stopped me and he said, "No." He said, "No, I don't think so." And in tune with the language that we use, he said, "I don't think so." He said, "You know, I think there's some words that I would like to reserve, and I only use these words to talk about God." Words like awesome or perfect. And he taught me something when he said that. I'm a little more careful in my language now. I still think it's neat when somebody does a good deed and it's really impressive and they've gone beyond to say, "Awesome. Thank you. Awesome." But I learned from my friend, vocabulary makes a difference. I wonder how many perfect people there are here today. Any perfect people? Are we? Perfect people. Any tens here? Perfect people. Well, let's see what Jesus has to teach us about this. I want to pick up at Matthew 6, and we want to pick up at the very beginning here. And Jesus is, remember, he's teaching his disciples. So these are people who are committed followers. These are people who are seeking to follow him, and he understands that. So Jesus has some challenging lessons for them to learn. And he starts off knowing, having already said to them, that the kingdom of heaven belongs to them. He kind of summarizes, and we're going to pick up at verse 16 and then move forward. He says, "Let your light shine before men, before others, in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." Well, if people aren't glorifying your Father in heaven because of you, we might take a moment to ask, why not? But those are powerful words. When you do something good, hopefully it reflects and points other people to God. So when you do your good works, they should glorify your Father who is in heaven. So then Jesus launches into a whole nother idea here. He transitions, and picking up at verse 17, he says, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets." Do not think. Well, Jesus wants to make sure that we don't misunderstand, that we make no mistake about what he represents here. Do not think, don't make a mistake in what you're thinking, that I came to abolish the law. Well, I think the part of the impressive impact here is that Jesus was sent. It wasn't just his idea to come. He was sent. He didn't just arrive and come accidentally, but he was sent for a purpose. Do not think that I came. But he has to clarify, because remember I said that Matthew was working with a Jewish Christian community. And these were people who had always been steeped in the Torah and knew very well the commands and the Jewish law inside and out. So he has to explain what he's about. Do not think that I came to abolish the law. Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. Well, Jesus, he goes on to say, I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Jesus is not an abolitionist. He did not come to set aside or to wreck the law or to wreak havoc. He came in order to fulfill. What he's saying is, I came in order to affirm, not to set aside the requirements of the law. I came to fulfill and to affirm. We might use a simple word there to understand, to do the law, to fulfill it. I didn't come to set aside the law or the prophets. What Jesus is trying to say to them is that the law that came before me and the prophets point somehow to me. And he'll go on to explain that or say a little bit more about that in just a moment. I didn't come to set them aside. They point to me. In me they are fulfilled, the law and the prophets. So for the law, Jesus is talking about the first five books of what we know as the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, Genesis through Deuteronomy. He's talking about these five books and then the prophets. And in the Jewish Bible, they broke them down into the earlier prophets and the latter prophets. What they called the earlier prophets ran from Joshua through Kings, and then from there you run through Isaiah, the latter prophets, through Malachi. We don't set it up that way, but in Matthew's time, those were the scriptures that his listeners would have been familiar with. So they understood what he was talking about when he says, I did not come to abolish or to set aside the law, the Torah, the first five books, or the prophets. They understand what he's saying. So now they're really listening. So why have you come? What is it that you're about? Well, don't think that I came to set these aside. I didn't come to do that, but to fulfill them, to affirm them. That's what Jesus really wants to do. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all is accomplished. So now Jesus inserts himself. He insinuates something here. Truly I say to you. You see, if it's accurate that the law and the prophets point to him, then he now holds and reserves the right to interpret. Other rabbis did this as well, so now Jesus steps in and it's time for him to interpret. But he's saying that these point to him and are fulfilled in his own person. Truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, and the implication is that they will pass away, but not in the meantime, not the smallest letter or stroke, not any jot or tittle, if you're familiar with the old King James version of this. shall pass away. How many of you had a grammar teacher or an English teacher perhaps in grade school, and they make sure that you crossed every T and dotted every I? Julie, did you do that in your third grade classroom? You make sure you don't make any mistakes. Make it look presentable. Get it right. This is what you do. Did you forget to cross the T? So Jesus is, what he's saying is, nothing shall be missed from the law. Truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all is accomplished, everything fulfilled. And then he goes on to say a little bit more. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments, the word annuls there, you know what that means? Anybody wearing a tie shoes today? It means to come untied. That's what annul means. Anybody who unties one of these commandments or says it's okay to set that aside, he just wants us to know that it's not okay to do that. They're all important, every last one of them. If you even omit one or say it's not okay to, if it's not important to do all of them, then you've missed the mark. They are all important. Whoever annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. It's not about lip service. It's not about knowing the commandments. It's about doing them. Whoever teaches them and keeps them, those are the ones who will be honored in the kingdom. I read a story about a little girl. A little girl was greatly distressed. She learned that her brothers had been trying to set traps to catch birds. And so later on, she came home and she was looking just a little bit sheepish, and her mother asked her, "What's wrong? Have you done something?" She said, "Well, I was praying that my brothers might not catch the birds." And her mother wisely asked, "Is there anything else?" She said, "Yes, I prayed that God would prevent the birds from getting caught in the traps." And then the mother thought for a second, a very wise mom, and said, "Is there anything else?" She said, "Yes, I went out and smashed those traps to bits." It's not just those who know and teach, it's those who also keep the law. Those are the ones that impress God. And I think Jesus is trying to tell us something important here about what we are called to do. He says, "I say to you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, those are strong words for his disciples because they already know that they are not necessarily righteous people. These are the common people. These are the people who weren't always as scrupulous and meticulous in every observance of the law. So when Jesus says, unless your righteousness actually exceeds, he doesn't say equals that of the Pharisees and scribes, because they have a reputation for keeping the law. They tithe. Do you know how far they went? They even tithe of the spices and seasonings that they put on their food. If you're going to put a teaspoonful, you take a tenth of that and tithe from that. That's how meticulous they were before God. And these were people who were common people who couldn't hope to live at that extraordinary level. And Jesus says to them, unless your righteousness actually exceeds theirs, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And so you might imagine that they were listening to Jesus and going, uh-oh, who can possibly reach this? Who can possibly do this? And they know it's absolutely and utterly impossible for them to do it. A little bit later on, Jesus tells them, you must be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Now, how many of you, again, think that you're perfect? Could you keep every aspect of the law? They struggle to do it. I'm not sure that we can either. But Jesus says to us, and it almost sounds like he's setting us up for failure. He is, but hold on for a minute. He is. He's saying, you and I, we must be perfect as our Father in heaven is perfect. So how many of you feel like giving up now? Forget it. I can never do that. Our righteousness doesn't even equal that of the Pharisees. They knew that their righteousness didn't. And Jesus says he raises the level. He ups the bar and sets it higher. He says your righteousness must exceed that of the Pharisees. And they must at that point have been shaking their heads going, how? How indeed is this ever possible? I can't do that. But that's what Jesus says. He says your righteousness must surpass that of the Pharisees, or you won't enter the kingdom of heaven. You have heard, and then he goes on to explicate. And that's what's important. What Jesus wanted us to know, remember, for those of you who weren't here last week, Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is yours. It belongs to you. He said, you are salt and you are light. Now, one of the things you have to understand about salt is that salt is what? How does it taste on your tongue? Salty. And how about light? What does light do? Don't make it harder than it is. It shines. Unless you put it out or extinguish it. Light shines, and salt? Salt tastes salty. It's a seasoning to preserve. It adds flavor. What he's saying is, that's who you all are. It's who you are. Jesus is undercutting. He's going to a very basic level. He says, now, the kingdom of heaven is yours, and you are salt, and you are light. This is your new identity. We spent all last fall on that one issue. We just need you to know who you are, not because I say so, but because Jesus says so. And if you have to put on your God eyes to see it, then do it. You see, he's trying to show us from a heavenly perspective who we really are. Now, most of us will say, based on our feelings or our accomplishments, I don't feel like salt some days. I don't feel very salty. I don't feel very bright. Things are a little dim in my life. Well, it's not about what you and I are going through. It's not about even what we see. It's about what God knows and God sees and God assigns. And he's given us a new identity. The kingdom of heaven is yours. You don't have to fight for it. It's yours going in. Remember last week we already said it's like going into a course and the very first day the professor says you all get an A. Now what are you going to do with it? Are you going to mess around? Are you going to skip every class after that? Are you going to give a half-hearted effort? Or are you going to engage? Knowing that you're free now to learn as much as you can and to enjoy yourself and rejoice. I got an A. I got an A. I'm perfect. I don't feel perfect, but my Father says in his eyes, I'm perfect. I'm perfect. Just say perfect. Now turn to somebody else and say, you're perfect. Come on, John. You can do it. Tell Joanne she's perfect. Now, how many perfect people are here? Are you having fun yet? Thank you, Bill. You're perfect. Come on in. Perfect. Perfect. This is who we are. We are perfect because God says so. It's in his eyes that we are. So what does that mean for us? Well, Jesus has raised the bar, and he wants us to understand what perfection looks like. And then he gives us this whole series of six scenarios or six antitheses, and each one has a threefold pattern to it. And in this threefold pattern, what we first get is that Jesus reaffirms the law. He doesn't set it aside and said, you don't have to do this anymore. He reaffirms it. But then he also radicalizes it, and then he reshapes it in a new way, and then he says, okay, and then the third part of it, he provides a scenario for us and says, this is how it plays out. He says, okay, I'm not setting aside the law, I'm fulfilling it. I'm telling you all that you're perfect going in. And he says, okay, so I've redefined it. Jesus steps in, and he says, I haven't set aside the law, but I am transcending it. And then I'm going to show you what it looks like to be perfect in this world. And he has six different episodes or scenarios that show us what it means to live a perfect life, to live as the Father does. Let's just take a look at some of these because they are important. Look at verse 21. You have heard the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, which means something like you dolt or you idiot, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court or the Sanhedrin. And whoever shall say you fool shall be guilty enough to go into the hell of fire. Now, what sense does that make? You see, Jesus first says, here's the law. He recapitulates it. You have heard that the ancients were told, both in the written scriptures and the oral tradition, the teaching of the elders, that you shall not commit murder. Where have you heard that? One of God's top 10 in the Ten Commandments. But Jesus, he kind of raises the bar here, doesn't he? He says, but I say to you Now this is where he steps in and transcends even the law. He says, I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. Look at the word brother there. It means brother or sister. What he's saying is, look around, the brothers and sisters, those who are part of the church body, the church family, those who are brothers and sisters in the faith, who are disciples like you. He's talking about that. When we become angry with those closest to us, so this has implications for how we interact with one another. He said, if you get angry with somebody else, you are guilty before the court. Now, how about that? Because Jesus first was talking about the law, which had something to do with murder. But now he's talking about getting angry. You see how he kind of raised the bar here? Now, is there anybody here who never gets angry? Oh, that's what I thought. Okay, I know how this works. We don't get angry. We just get what, Marty? Upset, right? Because we don't want to think of ourselves as people who really get angry. I call that anger light. But by any other name, you're still angry. Jesus upped the level. It's not just about murder, but it's about people who get angry. So he knows he's got us. We're all convicted. We all get angry. So what does Jesus say? Well, he says, if you get angry with a brother or a sister, you stand guilty before the court. And if you call somebody else a moron, if you say, you idiot, he says you could wind up before the Supreme Court of the land, the Sanhedrin in Israel. He's saying you're in big trouble. And if you go so far as to call somebody else a fool, then you are guilty enough to actually be cast out of the gate of Gehenna, which was a place where the rubbish, the town dump was that had caught fire outside Jerusalem. And it was hellish in nature. And you could be forced to go out there. He said, that's how bad it is. If you just get angry with your brother and you don't do anything about it. So what are they thinking? Well, the order gets more and more. You see, as people are listening to him, as I said, Jesus has radicalized the commandments now, and it's getting more and more absurd. You mean if I just get angry? You mean if I call somebody adult? You mean if I say, you fool, I could be cast into hell? And you see, it's absurd and getting more absurd, and Jesus is doing this deliberately. And he says yes, because he wants people to come to that point where they realize they're going to have to make a change. I can't do that. And he understands that. And he said, and then he offers the ante a little bit farther. He says, if therefore you are presenting your offering at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, what should you do? You leave the offering there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and present your offering. Well, okay, that works for us because we usually make a financial contribution. But if you brought a lamb and you were halfway into the sacrifice and the throat had already been slit and it's there bleeding, and Jesus says you're supposed to leave your offering if you suddenly remember, oh yeah, I hurt Tim's feelings. I could tell. I forgot. I need to go make things right. It just was inconceivable. Nobody would do that. It was just ridiculous. It was absurd. Not only that, but Jesus is saying wherever you are in the land, if this happens, he's actually telling them to go all the way to Jerusalem and make it right. Wait a minute. Nobody would do that. That could be several days' journey to make your way all the way to Jerusalem. It's an absolutely absurd scenario. It's not going to happen. Now, I need to tell you that in ancient Israel, there were occasions where they interrupted the religious rituals, but they would have done it for ceremonial reasons. Perhaps the lamb was blemished. It wouldn't have been a perfect offering, and therefore it wouldn't have been a pure offering. So if they discovered that, you could actually stop the offering. And once you had made it right, found perhaps a different lamb, then you could continue with the offering. But what Jesus did, he shifted the attention away from the religious ritual to the concerns that people have. He shifted it to what's really important in the eyes of God, and that's people and relationships. It's not about the ritual or the religiosity. It's not about the ceremonies. It's about how you treat other people. And he's bringing us full circle to what was really the impact and the importance and the significance of the law. It's about how we express our love for God in relationship to others. So Jesus is shifting, and he wants us to just see how absurd are some of the things and the customs that we keep without consideration for other people. And so Jesus has a recommendation. Well, if you You better make things right with your brother. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, in order that your opponent may not deliver you to the judge and the judge to the officer and you be thrown into prison. For truly I say to you, you shall not come out of there until you have paid up the last cent. What he's saying is, you can never pay enough. You can never satisfy God, so you better make up with your friends now while you're still alive, while you're on the way to the judge. While you're on the way, if there's something that you've done, if there's something between you and another person, while you still have breath and life, you better make it right. You better attempt to be reconciled in this life now, before your time runs out. Truly I say to you, you shall not come out of there until prison until you have paid up the very last cent. Well, you see, they listen to Jesus and going, oh boy, that's a pretty radical scenario. Here's the second one. He takes on another of the great commandments. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Well, Jesus just simply tells us what the law says. And now he steps in. But I say to you, now he wants to transcend the law and take us back to the original intent and the heart of the law, not just the legal aspect, but the very heart. I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Okay, so this isn't for the women, is it? He's talking to the men, right? All right, gentlemen, he's talking to us. If you have looked at a woman with lust, you have already committed adultery in your heart. You see, Jesus has blurred the line between the outward act and the inward thinking. If you have so much as felt it or wished it, you have basically, in the eyes of God, already committed adultery. Now, you can imagine the people listening to Jesus going, boy, what hope is there for us? We're in big trouble. What Jesus is trying to do, because men had in those days the right to issue a certificate of divorce, what he's really trying to do is protect women from predatory men. He's trying to offer protection. So he's speaking to the guys and saying, you have a responsibility. Of course, today I suppose you have to share that equally now. If anybody looks upon somebody else in lust, then that person has committed adultery already in the heart. But Jesus is taking us to a higher level. And then he goes on to say this. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out. What should you do if you lust? Well, if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it's better for you that one of the parts of your body perish than for the whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, what should you do? Cut it off and throw it from you. For it's better that that one of the parts of your body perish than for your whole body to go into hell. So he's really talking about self-mutilation here, isn't he? Now, I don't know. I've looked around. I've been around this congregation for 25 years. I don't see too many one-eyed, one-handed men. Do you? What that means is we have nobody here who actually lusts, right? Right? I think what it really means is that we don't take Jesus literally, do we? We don't see any men with their eyes, with one eye having plucked out, or with just one hand, and not your left. And it's the right hand that would have been removed, which was the good hand in those days. Sorry if you're a southpaw. The right hand and the right side was understood to be the good side. So Jesus is trying to tell them this is absurd. They would listen and go, oh, he doesn't mean this literally. So what does he mean? That's right. He wants to take us to the heart of the law. He wants us to reflect and go deep. He's also satirizing the notion, you're not going to pluck off your, cut off your hand or pluck out your eye. That's not going to happen when you lust. So you need to be careful here is what he's saying. And then he goes on to a third one, and he presses in a little bit here and goes a little bit deeper, and it's about divorce. And it was said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of dismissal. The law allowed for that. It did. But Jesus, he changes the direction. He says, but I say to you, and this is where he transcends the law, and his own authoritative position, I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Okay, that's a pretty high standard. And it's, again, meant to protect women from men who do the wrong thing. So this is a very high standard. And he places the responsibility on the men. He wants to make sure that they protect their wives and protect the integrity of marriage. And some people believe that it's a manuscript edition where Jesus says, except for the cause of unchastity. That's not present in every manuscript. It may be that that's not what Jesus said. It may be that he simply said, whoever divorces his wife, give her a certificate of dismissal, but I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife commits adultery. It may be that those were his actual words. And if he's saying that, then God help us, many of us, because that's a high bar that many of us cannot reach. And so Jesus goes on to another one. Scenario number four. Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it's the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. I guess if you can today with dye. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, and anything beyond these is of evil. So what's Jesus saying? If you have to swear that it's the truth, then you already have a problem. It's too late. Let your yes be yes. Are you coming? Yes, I am. No, I'm not. Just let your yes be yes. You shouldn't have to swear. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Well, you shouldn't have to swear. I tell the truth. We are truthful people. That's what Jesus is looking for from his disciples. Tell the truth. Even if it's painful and costly for you, tell the truth. Be the truth. Live the truth. Once again, he raises the bar. And then we look at the next section, beginning at verse 38. The fifth scenario. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And actually, that was meant to limit retaliatory damage. It meant, John, if I knocked out your tooth, you don't get to knock out my tooth and cut off my ear. It means, I'm sorry I knocked out your tooth, but a tooth for a tooth, an eye for an eye. But no more than that. It was meant to limit the violence between people so it didn't ramp up. This was actually a step forward. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, and once again, Jesus steps in and transcends the law. I say to you, do not resist him who is evil, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. What's he saying? Well, if it's the right cheek, the only way to do that would somebody would have to slap you with the back of their hand. That's the implication. And because you always would have used your right hand. So to get your right cheek, they would have had to come and hit you with the back of their hand. And this was in those days in ancient Israel, the worst sort of insult that you could offer somebody. In fact, it was punishable by a fine up to a year's wage. It was the worst insult that you could offer. So if somebody does that to you, Jesus says, do what? Don't resist. Turn the other cheek. Well, you got that one. Would you like to go for this one now? You see, Jesus is giving power to the victims. He's giving us a way to not resist, but to also assume control of the situation so that we don't have to feel like we're victimized by it. It goes a little further. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. What does that mean? Somebody tell me what that means. Do you know what that really means? What's a tunic? He's really talking about the undergarments. He's saying if somebody's going to take everything you have, take you for everything, even down to your underwear is what he's really saying, what should you do? Give them your coat also. What does that mean? Well, legally, somebody could take you for everything you have, but they can't take your overcoat. They can't take your cloak. They can't take you. By law, they couldn't take that. So what's Jesus saying to do? Give it to them. So can you picture what he's really saying now? Well, they've already got your underwear, so now take off your coat and give it to them as well. Do you see what he's saying? Do you really get what he's saying now? He's saying, stand there in court absolutely stark naked. He said, shame them. You have control. Well, you want my underwear? Well, take my coat as well. He's not saying to be the victim, but he's saying, give it all up. Don't resist. Let them have everything. And he's empowering the ones from whom it's taken. I wonder, today they're marching in Selma, Alabama after 50 years. I wonder what justice looks like. I wonder what it looks like now. I wonder what Jesus would have said. I think he probably would rejoice. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Walk out of court stark naked if you have to, and trust God to care for you. And whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him two. And give to him who asks you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. So Jesus is saying, overall, don't resist, but give. Or another way to say it, give in, and trust God. And then we come to the very last scenario here. You have heard that it was said, perhaps this is the most important of all, he saves the best and the hardest for last, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Well, there was a group of rebellious fighters known as zealots in ancient Israel, and they said, hate our enemies. There was a group of Essenes, and they went off to form a separate community for people who wanted to live righteously, and they said to hate sinners. And the Jewish law said it was not necessary for you to love your enemies. But what does Jesus say? Once again, he ups the bar, and he says, love. And if you love only those who love you back, everybody does that, good and bad alike. So what he says is, love also your enemies, because that's the way that God is. He says, do this, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, the bad, and the ugly, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brothers only, what do you do more than others? Do not even Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. So, there you have it. Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. What does that look like? I think William actually said it with the children. The golden rule. Do for others what you want them to do for you. So much of the law was predicated on what not to do, a very negative. Avoid trouble, avoid problems. Jesus has said what we're really supposed to do is actively pursue the good of others. Be righteous as your Father in heaven is righteous. Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. What he's really saying is, remember who we are? Salt and light, that's who you are. Let your light shine. Let your salt be flavorful. Let it be savory so that you can season the world. Let it out. It's there for others for their good. Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. This is how the Father sees us. Be like him. What he's basically saying to his disciples, remember, these are people who are devoted followers of his, who are making every effort to do what's right. He's saying, just let your light shine. He's saying, you are children of the Father, so act like it. Act like it. Act like who you are. Is this starting to make any sense? He's not saying it's all about trying. He's saying it's simply about understanding what the Father sees. And if we know that we are so secure in our relationship with the Father, we don't have to fight for his love. All we have to do is allow his love to show through us to others. I think that's what Jesus is trying to say. So if you have a love for the Father, then perhaps we really are perfect if we just allow that love of the Father to show through to others. Perfect. How many perfect people are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Everybody who's here, if you have a love for the Father, you can allow that love to show through to others. Let's pray.